Madam Speaker.
Madam Secretary.
Madam Vice President.
This is Madam Policy, a podcast about women shaping policy, creating history.
Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Dee Martin, and I'm joined today by my good friend and energy and environmental partner, Brittany Pemberton. Hello, Brittany.
Hi, Dee. Thanks so much for having me on with you.
Oh, it's going to be fun. I'm excited. So listeners, it is our honor to welcome to Madam Policy, policy veteran and amazing Chief Sustainability Officer for Baker Hughes, Allison Anderson Book. Welcome, Allison.
It's good seeing you guys. Thanks for having me. I like that you said policy veteran.
I know. I thought about that. And that is what you are, because you know policy and you have been through many a battle. So you get to be a policy veteran and you're here today to talk about it.
Indeed.
All right. So folks, we're going to get into Allison's battle in the policy sphere. But first, you should know that she started her professional life as a trained geologist. She then parlayed her expertise and academic firepower into policy work, serving in senior positions in the executive branch and in Congress. I had the pleasure of first meeting Allison when she was in a senior position on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, where we talked all things helium all the time. And we're going to circle back to that. Allison is widely and properly recognized as a leader on energy and sustainability issues. But you don't just have to take my word for it. Listen to this. She's been named a top 10 women leading energy transition and sustainability among the 25 influential women in energy and as an ESG champion of the year. Also, under her leadership, Baker Hughes has been consistently recognized for sustainability, including being an industry mover in S&P's Sustainability Yearbook 2023, a Most Trustworthy Companies 2023, and Most Responsible Companies 2023. Those are lists by Newsweek. Congratulations, Allison. Look, I don't even know where to start with you, honestly. Let's just start with hello and how are you?
You know, I'm better now that I'm hanging out with you guys.
Yay! Good. Come back always. So listen, I think of Baker Hughes as an energy technology company, really. I'm not sure that's how everyone thinks about it, but that's how I think about it. And you have this really broad array of technologies and solutions for a really wide variety of applications, right? You've got oil field services, you've got hydrogen, LNG, CCUS. Really, you're doing everything that is important and hot topic in energy right now. But the through line to me seems to be developing technologies that enable your customers to optimize their efficiency and increase sustainability in their energy projects. So that's what you do externally, right? So that's customer facing. But Baker Hughes also has its own net zero objectives for itself. So can you describe your role as Chief Sustainability Officer? And are you focused on external or internal on or both in terms of sustainability?
So it's both.
Okay.
And the company, so you characterized it well.
Okay.
When you look at, so I'm going to get a little nerdy because that's what I do.
Good.
And then I'm going to explain kind of why my job is the way it is.
Okay.
When you look at the company's emissions profile, we are dominated in two different ways. So when you think about, we're a two-segment company, we have an oil field service and equipment. Note the equipment's in there. Mm-hmm. And then we have the industrial energy tech manufacturing for the other segment. So there's manufacturing on both of that. Even though Baker Hughes' name is still tagged with oil field services, mm-hmm. our emissions footprint is dominated by the manufacturing and use of our products downstream from us. Okay, so when you look at the company that way, mm-hmm. that it's in the products that we're manufacturing and selling, okay, then that tells you that our emissions journey doesn't end at our door.
Right.
So we have a net zero goal as a company. So it's the similar science-based target aligned net zero goal that companies have, and that's to get to net zero by 2050. Mm-hmm. And we've made really good progress on that. So me and my team, we work on that. But the other part that really got me interested in coming to Baker Hughes is the nexus of our downstream emissions and how we create products and services that end up on our customer's door. And if we do it right, we'll actually reduce their emissions,
right?
So I work in both of those spheres. Mm-hmm. And actually, I like the policy veteran thing because a big part of the enablement of the uptake of emissions reduction kinds of technologies, practices, even down to the manufacturing, really comes out of a policy impetus.
Right.
So we're not going to see an energy transition happen without that. So I've got both our emissions reduction journey and that of our customers that we're working on. They're both fascinating. I should say 99% of our emissions are dominated by are downstream and upstream emissions.
Right. I mean, and that makes sense. I get that. I get that. Okay. That's a good way to explain it. Thank you, Allison.
Allison, let me ask you this. As a global company, you know, that's operating in something like 120 countries, I imagine a big part of your job right now is ESG reporting and working to harmonize or meet, you know, myriad local requirements. In one interview, you noted that the EU requirements are particularly serious and complicated. How do you tackle those new reporting requirements at home and around the world?
So I think because I came into this job with that regulatory background, mm-hmm. so it was policy and then regulatory work. For anybody who doesn't know me, I spent almost 5 years working on Deepwater Horizon reforms mm-hmm. as well and looking at like some pretty major rulemaking. So you get an idea of what it means to derive, like make a compliance program, right. enforce it. And then I've been on the other side when I've worked for an operator and I've got that view of what it takes from that side to comply with it. Okay. And so when I came into the role, the train had already left the station. You could see based on what was happening in the world on the energy transition that countries were going to start to regulate in this space. It was just when and how far will they go, right? And so very early on, when I first got to the company, we sat down and started saying, like, look, we're going to have to report this at some point. And also we need it as a proof point to our customers mm-hmm. because it's so important. So like the EU's requirements are hard today, but we've been working on literally since I got here, even before they published mm-hmm. them, because there was an idea already on the street of what that looks like, right? But for us, if we don't treat this incredibly seriously, like you guys go and you get your hair cut, you walk into the barbershop or the beauty salon and the person's got like really bad head and they clearly don't care how they look, or you're like, you know what, I'm gonna go outside and pick another hairdresser. And so if we don't
don't sit in that chair, that's what you do. You do not do it.
You don't sit in that chair. And so if we're like, we're a technology provider and we're making a promise on our emissions reduction, we better be very good in reporting mm-hmm. and reducing our emissions.
But how do you, so Allison, how do you harmonize that across the countries when there are different, look, we used to talk about this domestically, not in the ESG space, but domestically all the time, patchwork quilt, right? How do you meet all of the different, but now you're doing that globally. How do you harmonize that? Or do you just take this toughest standard, you meet that?
You take the hardest one.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that's where we were headed. So we started to work on, when you look at ESG data, right? So none of that is collected on systems where, like unlike accounting standards, there's systemic record keeping. A lot of the information that comes in for emissions in particular is just a utility bill, right? And then you convert that over to the emissions number. And in the case of Scope 3, it's like somebody's got to go figure mm-hmm. out like who the waste hauler is and then find out how to get the bill from them. So it becomes like this, but that's the hardest part, is how do we get that kind of information into a digital system mm-hmm. in enough time that it meets a financial level of reporting and rigor? And so that's why we're just building it to a very high standard right now. Because the EU really set the bar, because off the back of that, it's not just the EU. Malaysia came out with something similar. They have an open comment period happening right now. They put it out last week on what they're proposing that is aligned to something called the International Sustainability Standards Board. Mm-hmm. They're aligning to that, which is essentially what the EU has done. So we're seeing this global raising of the bar, if you will, on the regulatory requirements around this. I would say in this case, the SEC is a laggard. And so while people are worried about that, we look at that as not particularly difficult compared to what you kind of deliver in the EU, which I kind of am laughing inappropriately because it's that hard. It's super hard and it's a lot of money. But I like hard things and I like a good challenge.
Yeah. Well, that I do know about you.
It's so exciting for you all as a corporation to think about being on the leading edge of all of that, that you've already bitten off the biggest, most challenging piece of it.
Yeah.
And to see the trend of all the other regulators headed in that direction must be really heartening.
Yeah. I mean, we still get this thing where I've had to balance our sector right now is one of those time periods where a lot of companies are constricting a bit again. Mm-hmm. And even though some have really great revenue coming in, they're still looking at the workforce in a different way. And there's a bit of a changing of the guard happening, right? And so when you're in a period like that, you've got to think a lot about cost. And so now that there's this tension that's been happening that you don't want to get so far in front of where regulations or the market would go that you are sticking your neck out.
Right.
Yeah. That's the balance.
Yeah. It doesn't make financial sense to be a fast follower, because the way that you've got to set up a system like what we've got to do for this kind of reporting is so complicated when you are in so many countries and have so many legal entities that you can't expect to do it in a year. Like, this is a 3 to 6 year compliance period. So it's just a totally different game. And so a lot of what we think about too is, how do we leverage this to differentiate the company on a commercial basis? And then also help us take both cost and carbon out.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
While the people listening to the podcast can't see it, I know Brittany and Dee can on my wall. I have our All In Carbon Out, which is a program that hopefully I'll get a chance to highlight, because that's a big part of where we're headed.
Yeah, I do want to hear about that. And I've seen that behind you in other interviews that I've seen of you. And I wanted to ask you about that. But I'm going to pivot just a little bit. When I was thinking about this interview, I just kept thinking, every time I read something or heard you speak, I was thinking, you know, you really are in the right place at the right time. And I'm going to use this as an example, your congressional testimony from last year. So Baker Hughes has subsurface technology and a workforce that is really expert in deploying that technology through its years of work in the oil and gas production space. And you noted in this testimony that this technology and these skills could be transferred to produce geologic hydrogen, which of course is something that everybody is talking about right now. And in fact, we just had on Dr. Evelyn Wang, head of ARPA-E at DOE, who is brilliant, and DOE Undersecretary Dr. Jerry Richmond, also brilliant. And I just had them on the show and I asked both of them about geologic hydrogen. And of course, everybody's just talking about it right now. So what is Baker Hughes doing in the geologic hydrogen space today, given your existing expertise in oil and gas production?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of different ways I would back it out and like give you a kind of a full-bodied view on just the hydrogen system itself, right? I'll say, starting as a geologist, I always want to start in the subsurface, but I'm going to start actually with production, which is very against like my normal DNA here. But basically, we've been in the hydrogen game since like the early, 1900s. Baker Hughes, I guess it would have been a legacy GE or Nova Pignone back then. But that was, they made the world's first hydrogen compressor. And then we made the world's first hydrogen turbine, somewhere in the 50s or 60s. This is kind of old technology, actually, even though we're having this like hydrogen moment in hype. We've been in the space for a really long time. And so we really have been topsides for that part. Okay. The other aspect of this, now we're looking more and more on the actual production, not just the how you compress it and, and utilize it as a fuel type, but then how can you generate it in the first place? Okay. And so, because we look at that nexus of hydrogen and natural gas is really an incredible opportunity, right? In an orderly energy transition, you're going to want to see phase down of certain things while you turn things on. And so another industry first was really on our, since for people who are listening, if you're familiar with what we do in LNG, we have a series of different kinds of turbines. And we now had the world's first hydrogen natural gas blend turbine. And so we're working on the scale up and being able to transition that turbine so you can change that fuel mix. So let's say you started heavy on natural gas, and as you transition through time, you get more and more of the hydrogen that's produced and you can offtake that for combustion. Yeah. Suddenly you displace that in your system. That's pretty amazing, right?
That is amazing. Yeah.
So while you're doing that, you got to think about hydrogen storage. Maybe you don't have the offtake agreement. That's where pivoting to the subsurface.
Yeah.
That we have the standard kind of, you need a person to come in and look at the subsurface, really think about well construction, handling of converting that well, mature asset. Like, we're doing a lot of that bread and butter work that applies across the board for that. There's another space in between. We have a lot of digital kit as well, and inspection services, et cetera, where we work in pipelines from the outside and from the inside out. Yeah. That would apply in a hydrogen setting, as well as we have something that we call flexible non-metallic pipe. So we've spent a lot of time, my team has, in looking at the difference between conventional steel and then having a substitute for conventional steel, because there's advantages by not having that. One is your carbon footprint. So we have great data analysis that shows this better. There may be an instance where you could take an existing pipeline and fit a non-metallic sleeve on the inside and make it a conversion space for hydrogen. And so that's been an area that we've been looking more and more at the credibility of that and how hard it would be technically to do that. So we are present throughout the value chain.
Yeah.
And the geologic side is just one part of it.
So you have an R&D team in place.
Yeah. So we've had an R&D team. I would say we've got a policy and funding team.
That's right.
Been helping to catalyze public funding so that we could turn on more pace, okay, of deployment of technology and also de-risk some of the earlier TRL, the technical readiness level, like in the 3-4 range, and get those pieces of tech into a higher TRL faster. And so last year we were able to just about double the public funding we've been pulling in for R&D, which is excellent. It's excellent. So we're continuing to advance that a lot more, and we're looking at like hubs. And so some of it's R&D, but we've got a lot of focus on the demonstration deployment phase, because when you look at where we have mature tech, that plays into that a little bit more.
Sure.
So it's all over the place, really.
That's great. Thank you, Allison.
I love those examples that you gave, though, especially that natural gas and hydrogen turbine. You know, it's exciting to think about how you all are able to assist your customers really with the energy transition as they've got natural gas turbines in the LNG space that are reaching the end of their useful life. You can give them that sort of transition product that gives them time and you know, for other parts of the market and the regulatory space to catch up to the point where they're going to need the hydrogen, and they'll already be ready, which I just think is fabulous.
Yeah, you know, we actually have our campus in Florence where we do a lot of the heavier manufacturing that plays into the hydrogen and testing of the turbines and things like that. We just put in a hydrogen storage facility there so that we're able to have like get more and test it higher volumes of hydrogen. And so if you guys ever get over to Florence, Italy, come visit. I think you'll enjoy seeing some amazing hydrogen and carbon capture kinds of technology.
That sounds phenomenal.
I think it's imperative that Brittany and I see that. You have to go too.
Not only do I love Italy, I love a facility tour. Any kind of facility.
Too.
I love
there
it.
There is no better way to actually understand what people are doing on the ground beyond going there. Yeah. I mean, it's just you do need to be on the ground. So count us in.
All right.
We will come to your facility.
Next year, annual meeting. Consider yourself invited.
Perfect.
All right.
We're done. We are there. I will pack now.
So speaking of things that I also love, I wanted to pivot to a topic that's like very near and dear to my heart, which is supporting women in the energy industry. You know, Baker Hughes has been recognized by Forbes as one of the world's top female-friendly companies, which is a phenomenal achievement in and of itself. But as a former president of the DC chapter of the Women's Energy Network, I know firsthand what a huge supporter the company is of WEN's mission, which is to connect women in the energy industry, both locally and globally, while helping them foster in themselves, you know, career and leadership growth. But what are some of the other ways that Baker Hughes is working to, you know, foster inclusion and diversity in the industry? There's obviously a lot of headway and challenges to be met there, but I know you guys are on it. So what can you tell us there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a sectoral problem, really, is that on gender diversity in particular. And so this is one we've been taking really seriously. And what I love is we've got a great, a phenomenally talented woman who runs our DEI efforts. Her name is Nicole Durham. And she and I have these great, because I sit on the data collection side. And so I'll be like, I just happen to notice because we looked at the data. And she's like, I know, Allison. And we have these really deep conversations like, what does it take to get meaningful change, right? And so it starts with that acknowledgement that we first have a problem. And so when we see it, we say something. And I think that that's great because we've been changing the culture of our company so that if there is something that isn't quite right, you can call it out without the fear that it's going to have blowback. All right. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of like, we've got a lot of different kinds of initiatives we have. I want to highlight a leadership program that we have that's unique to women, since we're on the women topic, that's called Cultivate. And we take people that are rising from like a more junior to a more senior level, and we put them in this year-long program where they get to interact with people across the company. And we're a company of 58,000 people, all right? And so it'd be really easy to sit and only know 10 people in a virtual environment. But what Cultivate does is it brings people together across the entire part of the company so that they get that business exposure that they wouldn't have outside of their team, which I think is excellent.
Because that's great.
When you sit in predominantly male teams, you don't even see that there are other women in the company. And so it's like breaking down the silos around that, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. We also have a really active and strong internal women's network for a long time, it's been our biggest employee resource group, although my own Renew, which is a community of interest, is what we call it. And it's another employee group. I think we're neck and neck on a number of people in it. And so that one's about sustainability. So, so you know, it's friendly competition, but they overlap and we get together routinely. I want to give you one more thing. And then more broadly, the company, when I came in, was really at that the point of majorly changing itself, okay, in 2019. And I happened to actually have this great, I call him my onboarding buddy, and he was the head of recruiting for us. He now goes, he works for another company, but he's a really, really thoughtful guy. And something in how we were talking over the time that he and I knew each other, he knew that I liked experimenting and trying things. And I really like for all people to have voice, have a real voice. And so he was trying to help me navigate some of the challenges that I personally have in working in a virtual kind of environment because the pandemic happened and everything. And he asked me what I thought about neurodiversity. And so we had a lot of really great conversations about employing people with a range of different thought capabilities. Diversity in how we think oftentimes is far more important than the diversity we see. And so this company in that in the time since has really invested a lot in making sure that all of the people who get together, whether they look alike or not, they put a priority on, can we increase the thought diversity? And it's even on our recruiting page. So it says, if you're hiring for a role, this is your chance to think about thought diversity, basically on your team, which I think is amazing. Because that was
great.
There.
That is amazing.
And I have a deliberate internship program that we created to bring in people who are neurodiverse because they have, for what we're recruiting for, amazing computational skills.
Yep. That's great.
And I love
That's great.
I love it.
Yeah.
So it inspires me to get up and go to work every morning.
I love that. And I'm really glad that you talked about it here. I did have an idea while you were talking, and you can just think about this. Okay. I can follow up with you.
Yeah.
What if we invited Nicole and one of the women from your Cultivate program to come on the show and talk about that?
That'd be great.
Because it sounds great.
It's a great program.
Okay. So I'll follow up with you on that.
Okay, great.
Okay. So now we're going to go back to when I first met Allison. You were on the Hill, Senate ENR, as I mentioned, and we were talking about helium, the wonderful, wonderful helium. And we were wrestling around with what to do with the federal helium reserve. Were we going to sunset it? Were we going to extend it? Were we going to require tolling for refiners? That was the big issue. It was a lot. But you did ultimately and successfully pass the Helium Stewardship Act. Of course, it's, you know, still ongoing today and there are still, you know, we're still talking about it. So, but I'm not going to ask you here about helium unless you have thoughts on it. But I want to know, you know, you did that work and then you were in the administration and then, you know, you eventually go into private practice. A lot of people who are listening to this show are experiencing a similar journey. And so how did you make the decision to go to private practice? And what was one thing that you wished you had known when you made the transition? But first, tell me the first word that comes into your mind when I say helium.
Awesome. I'm happy to give
that's the right answer.
The tiniest bit of color. Okay. And so,
okay.
And this is a story, and this is why I feel really passionate about helium. There are people in the world who work behind the scenes. And if all those people vanished overnight, the world wouldn't work. That's how helium is. All right.
Yes.
That's totally how it is. It's in so many processes.
Yes.
And I am someone who had cancer early when they were younger and when I was in my 20s. And, you know, we're able to locate that because of medical imaging. And those machines don't run without helium. And so, and literally anybody who's ever had an MRI has experienced helium, okay? Not just particles. Yeah. And so this is why I am so incredibly passionate about it because, like, I might not be alive today if that didn't exist, okay?
Well, then I'm glad that there was helium and that you were able to detect and you're in remission. But two, I'm super glad that you worked on the Helium Stewardship Act because I was teasing you about it a little bit because it was such an, there were only six of us really working on this. But it was so impassioned.
Yes.
It was, people were really passionate.
Everyone felt so excited to talk and some are hostile and some are, you know, but it's
important.
And it's an unsung hero and more people need to know about why that's important. So
we ran you out of the Senate on helium and you sought refuge in the administration to work on oil spills. So, yeah.
Yes, yes. All very exciting stuff. I mean, the career transition, I do get asked this from time to time because my career has been less predictable. Mm-hmm. And so just for people to know, I started in working in an academic sense for a long time, and I was in school for a bazillion years, and then hatched and went over to Exxon, mm-hmm. right? And so I started in the private sector. I had the opportunity to be a science fellow, all right? And I knew about that from well before going into the private sector for the first time, and I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what, like, science and policy was about. Honestly, I had no idea. And my friends used to tease me and say, you can't even name, like, the 50 states. I'm like, yes, I can, and they're like, and they're like, who's Secretary of State? And I was like, I'm the internet. I mean, and back then, I wasn't remotely thinking about this. But what I did know is I had the intellectual curiosity to think about how science plays out in the public forum, right? And so when I could apply, I applied and I got the job. And then I stayed there like 6 years longer than I thought I would. So, but coming back out, okay, as a scientist coming in, that's the first hard part to break the barrier. And so I think that's the benefit of the science policy fellowships. But coming back out, what's so interesting is that you get this big swath of different stakeholders that you engage with. And you do get offered jobs, right? Sure. And I mean, if you're doing a good job at what you're there to do, and that's to represent the public taxpayer in a meaningful way and doing things for the greater good, people are going to see that, okay? And so that's the pivot then over to the administration, mm-hmm. because I'd started the Deepwater Horizon work and they said, can you come over and help continue to do that work? But popping back out, I went to a nonprofit, and I've had the tremendous honor of running mm-hmm. two amazing geoscientific mm-hmm. nonprofits. Mm-hmm. And that's the Lord's work.
Yeah,
right
it
there.
Is.
Okay. Because that's a super hard consensus driven mm-hmm. space. It is as bureaucratic as the federal government. And shockingly, so is the private sector. Okay. And so that pivot then out, when I got called about this particular role, I didn't go lightly into this. I really didn't see myself into the job. But what made the pivot is they were looking for a unique mix of experience mm-hmm. that was diversified, technical credibility, and the policy, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Yeah. And so they wanted all those things together. So the advice I always give people that are looking to jump back out into the private sector is you've got to be good at something.
Yep.
And that sounds really weird, but it's easy in policy to be a jack of all trades, mm-hmm. right? But you've got to have that specialty area that you can really excel at. And for me, I didn't realize that was energy transition. Yeah. But when you think about I mean, all of the things that I was working on for all those years, it was all energy transition. And I'll give my husband a mm-hmm. shout out that when I saw the role that Baker Hughes had, I really didn't see myself in it at all. Okay. And he basically looked at it and said, what are you talking about? And I think, do you know?
I do. I do. Yeah.
What are you talking about? Like it's like literally your dream job.
He can't.
And he translated it. And so look,
I was just about to say, he is an amazing translator. I mean, he speaks policy. He speaks private sector. He speaks administration. He speaks all of it. And he is a great consensus builder.
Yes.
And he can translate anything for anyone. And I'm glad that he's also doing it for you.
Yeah, he was doing it for
and I'm
me.
Sure Baker uses too.
Yeah, you should just hear them out, you know. And so I went through that process and he was so encouraging. And this goes back to the women's issue for just a brief moment, is that I maybe didn't see that I had all of what it took for that job, which is such a classic.
It so is. Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
But he saw it and he said, this is, you have everything. And
thank him for all of us.
Yeah. I will share this podcast with him so that he can hear that I said this in a public forum. I am grateful because that changed again, the trajectory of where I went in my career. And it's been a tremendously great experience to work in this company. So there's no secret sauce except for being very good at your thing, okay? Having excellence when you do it, right? I mean, right now, the thing I think about day in and day out is pretty much like, how are we going to comply with things, but also differentiate at the same time? I couldn't do that if I hadn't held on to a lot of the technical chops that I started my career with.
Right. Coupled with the policy chops that you developed after you learned the states that you developed over time.
Exactly. Exactly. And then I was like, oh yeah, now I know who the Secretary of State is. And honestly, everything changed for me, Dee, was I was sitting in a room like my first year. on the Hill. And I realized I'm in the room with, I think there were two cabinet members and four senators and three staff. And I thought, this is fascinating. These people are in line for the presidency. And then I finally realized, I'm like, so this is an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. You had your aha moment. That's awesome.
I did. And then I was no longer dazzled by like celebrities or anything because I was in the Beltway and now we're dazzled by wonkiness.
I love wonkiness. They are our celebrities. CERAWeek is like going to the Golden Globes. The best.
That's so true.
The ultimate wonkiness. Yes.
It is.
So maybe to transition back just one more minute to your work in the decarbonization space, and maybe that'll give you a chance then to talk a little bit more about All In Carbon Out. Part of your focus as the Chief Sustainability Officer is on supporting, you know, commercial energy transition solutions. We've talked a lot about that already, including CCUS. But how do you and how does the company identify emerging technologies to invest in and partnerships to forge?
You know, we talk about the hard truths a lot about what it takes to really transition a company and an economy towards net zero. And one of the key ones was the role of collaboration, because so many of the conventional ways that energy has been produced, okay, have been, you know, it's been kind of formulaic in the same way for a long time. But introducing abatement technology, just having a particular widget doesn't work. It is a value chain of solutions that come together for the answer. And so you've got to, suddenly the role of the customer and the vendor are shifting. And so a lot of our customers become our business partners, co-investors, or are in competition with us, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the role of collaboration right now is top of mind, right?
Yeah.
And then a lot of the public funding that comes out, you've got to have really great lab partners, you've got to have academics and things like that. And so this is something that we really focus a lot on. And so I've got a team under me that actually runs our external engagement and internal engagement on the energy transition. And so externally, we have like, it's kind of a mind-blowing number, 350 plus outside organizations that we engage with. And those are customers. Okay.
Wow.
So that's like trades and NGOs and Georgia. Yeah. And so that's a lot. And and we, you know, 4 years ago didn't even have line of sight to all of those. But now we have figured out how to then take all the insights that we learn from that. And we're improving that all the time for knowledge sharing across the company. And that helps us engage our employees, which gets to the second part on our carbon abatement journey. And so same team is managing how we engage employees across the company, because a lot of them do the outside engagement, but they're also the people that have to make the choices to behave differently. All right. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic was a really fascinating thing. I mean, like hardly anyone's talking about the pandemic anymore, but for our Carbon Out program, it was critical. So we were building that program out like in the middle of the pandemic. And this is where all of those, like at least 2/3 of our workforce was sitting in their home office. So what does that mean to a company like ours? That means we have a moral obligation to think about how to reduce emissions in our employees' workplace at home.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so we had a couple of projects that we were just to see, because how the accounting goes for emissions is typically like the hybrid environment. It's only the space that you control directly, like a office building, that's counted. But our employees choose to operate at home in a certain way too. And so we defined the accounting and we basically started to account for our employees' home emissions. By shining a light into that corner, you suddenly have an opportunity where people can make choices at home that benefit work and home and help them save money at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So we put some meters in people's homes so they could see what their power intake was for their office.
Yeah.
And we quantified the different devices. We looked at different climate regimes, et cetera. So we really nerded this thing up. Okay. And the analysis was excellent. And so over time, more people have returned to the office. So that number declines every year. But we use that as the starting place where we were getting people to think about doing something for Baker Hughes is easy because you're doing it at home. right?
Yeah. So Allison is fun because she quantifies everything, right? Everything is based on this data analysis.
I like data.
What an incredible, you know, initiative though. And for you all to take on that responsibility, you know, who said you had to do that? You just as responsible, you know, corporate citizens decided that that's was an appropriate step to take. And yeah, mind boggling to think about all the different parameters of that and the variables with people's different setups and everything. So very cool.
Oh yeah. It was fascinating. And actually, there's a woman on my team. Her name is Joanna. And she really, this was her project for a while. And we had a second phase. We started small. We got a little bit bigger. And, you know, what we learned from it was sometimes people are a little nervous because maybe they're not sure what they're going to find. Right. But I will say now our leadership team is almost completely different now. And they're even more engaged today on the topic than they were then. But nobody. Question this.
See, I think that's just amazing because really, Allison, every part of your job could be an individual's full-time job. So I'm not sure how you've crammed all of these things into one job. And so I can see someone saying to you, we aren't required to do that. You said we have a moral imperative to do that, but we have so much to do. We don't have the time for that. And nobody pushed back. I think that's fascinating.
Well, I think part of it was that everyone was coming up the learning curve, but it was this great opportunity just to think for a really low level of spend. I think that pilot cost us $5,000 or something. I mean, it was so inexpensive, right? We just basically put smart meters and we paid for the electrician to come in so we could collect that data and learn a little bit more. It also helped us open the door for understanding employee commuting, which is something we actively report on as well. And we get all of this assured. And so for us, this was that it's really the entry point for how then we turned on the full scale carbon out program, which now we have 250 formal champions who do this as part of their day job. Okay. And they look for opportunities to reduce emissions by a range of different things. And right now we're focused on scope 1 and 2 emissions, but phase 2 is coming, and phase 2 is going to be the rollout of our scope 3 emissions reduction program, which is going to be a mini decadal program that we run. And so I envision these ultimately don't sunset until we see that we've made really big behavioral changes across how we operate from day to day. But it starts at home. And I'm so proud of the fact that people saw that we needed to take a little bit of a risk on the front end with employee engagement to see what would happen as a result. And I think people have even forgotten that we worked on that project, but I don't, because for me, that was critical in turning on carbon out.
I think that's great. It sounds like a great project, and I'll be interested to see or to know if other companies sort of similarly situated to Baker Hughes adopt something like that, because it's smart. I think there's an employee engagement piece of it, which I think you mentioned earlier, that people feel invested, like they're part of it. I think it's a great idea.
Oh, we do. We have tons of invested employees.
That's great. So I'm going to sneak in one more energy question before we wrap up here,
all right,
because it is one more hot topic that you are intimately involved in. Your CEO has spoken about the federal government's recently announced LNG pause. In his words, he considers it a disappointment. He opposes the moratorium, but noted that the pause won't stop the proliferation of natural gas. So as Chief Sustainability Officer, what are your views on the pause? And does it alter what you're doing from your sustainability perspective?
So the pause is a moment in time, right?
Yeah.
And I think that we saw what's happened in the last couple of years with energy rebalancing throughout Europe and in other parts of the world. And natural gas gives us a lot of flexibility. All right. Now, you know, the where this gets pretty nuanced, because, as you know, I got to pull it back to the sort of carbon accounting piece of this is when you start to talk about natural gas and then LNG, and sometimes those get used interchangeably, but they're not exactly the same, because natural gas, if you're producing it domestically and using it domestically, is going to have a different footprint. And this has been a really controversial place in the last 3 to 5 years, where, you know, one group comes out with this life cycle analysis, another one comes out with this, and it usually stacks to whatever argument someone's trying to make.
Sure.
So the pause from a global supply challenge piece is temporary. Okay. But if it weren't temporary, it could have some pretty meaningful consequences, particularly if you've got areas of the world that perhaps could get that as a supply for the first time. So there's an access and there's a security challenge around that. Now, that I brought up the emissions because others have said that that's a solution on the emissions side. Well, I try not to put things out if I don't have the definitive number and there's too much controversy. But I will say there are very good numbers around the use of natural gas that say the emissions are lower than other fuel types. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we'll just continue to work on making sure that we understand how to take the emissions profile of the movement of that product around the world down as well. And so for me, it doesn't necessarily change my day job at all, because I see that we're going to still be in the natural gas space. I think it's an excellent bridge. And ultimately, because we're going to need natural gas for helium, okay,
yes,
it's never going away.
That's right. That's right.
It's always going to be a destination side, too. It's just scope and scale. You know, where will it be and who will use it, et cetera. But, you know, taking it back to just the most basic thing, the pause is pause. It's not a termination.
Thank you for that. And I will just note for the record that I speak on behalf of everyone in the whole world that you need to get back into the policy side of things. You really do. Like, I know, and I'm sorry, Baker Hughes, we love you, but we need Allison back in the policy space. That's all I'll say.
The policy space is fun. And, I dabble still. I get it.
I know you're still there, but like, I need you on the Hill making decisions is what I'm saying. but only sometimes on helium. I'll let you know. All right. Here's my last question for you. And this is the question that we end every episode with. What advice would champion of sustainability and geoscientist, and I'll add data lover, Allison Anderson Book, give to her 24-year-old self?
Focus on things that matter.
Yeah.
Everything else is noise. Everything else is just doesn't matter, right? Focus on the things that make a difference in the world and that motivate you to get up and find that sliver of joy. Too often we're caught up with consumerism and, keeping up with other people. And what does that get us? No one's ever really that happy about it. So I think I was caught up with it then, but because I had my health issue at that time.
Sure.
That was my gut check. And I live my life very differently as a result of that.
Oh, that is great and sage advice, Allison. Thank you so much for being on Madam Policy today. We loved having you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to Madam Policy. I think it's another great episode. Please download or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And rate and review the show, which is really helpful to have other listeners find it. If you have someone that you think would be a great guest for Madam Policy, please send us their name. You can tweet at us, find us on Instagram, and contact us by the links in the bios. Thanks so much.
This podcast was recorded in the studios of
Policy Resolution Group, Washington, D.C.